Today on Sic'em 365, we sit down with one of everybody's favorite premium members, Set Shot, sponsored by the Baylor Club. With Ashley Hodge, I'm Weston Rogers.
Welcome to 365 podcast, and we have a special guest today. We have Set Shot on the podcast, and he's a Baylor Bear legend. He's certainly a message board legendary figure, been posting for many years at Baylor Fans and various websites, and is a great contributor to Sic'em 365. So his real name is Stacy Cole. And Stacy, why don't you just start off by telling us about your background at Baylor and how you came to Baylor, and tell us, we know you played basketball for Baylor, maybe some of your memories there and what your Baylor experience was like.
Sure, Ashley. Let me start out by saying that I grew up in Texas. I was born in Mississippi. My father was a Baptist preacher, and he moved from Mississippi to Texas, and I was always grateful for that. Lived in Refugio and then moved to Corpus Christi when I was in the seventh grade in 1944 during the war, and it was a big Navy town, so that was quite an experience for me growing up there. And my senior year, to the surprise of everyone, because Corpus had never done anything in basketball in high school, they'd had great football teams, James Jeffrey and Buddy Parker and a number of others who went to Baylor and many who went elsewhere. They turned out a lot of football players in those years, and they were two state track championships and so on, but never had done anything in basketball. We didn't even have a gym until my senior year. And so my senior year, we won the state championship, and that was very unexpected. And it was at a time when the four major cities in the state formed their own conference. And that, I think this went on for about three years. They had the big city conference, and why they did that, I'm not sure. But it certainly paved the way for us to win a state championship, because I'm not so sure that we could have beaten the big city teams at that time. At any rate, it was an interesting time, and I was able to get a scholarship to Baylor. And based on that, and I was delighted, because it was a Baptist school. My father was a Baptist preacher, and I'd grown up in the church, had two older brothers that were ministers. And it was what I knew. It's kind of like a coach's son that goes into coaching because that's what he knows, or sure, a banker's son who goes into banking because that's what he knows and grows up with it. And so I thought when I went to Baylor that I would probably become a preacher, but I discovered along the way that was really not my calling. It was my interest, but not my calling. And so, but my time at Baylor was well spent. I have to say that it was the most enjoyable 4 years, I think, of my life. I roomed in old Brooks Hall, and there were four to a room, and it was a suite, so there were four on the other side. So there were eight young men up there ragging on each other all the time, and it was a lot of pranks, a lot of hilarity. The dining hall was right at the rear of Brooks Hall, the athletic dining hall, so we would do that, and then after dining we would all gather out in the quad a lot of times and carry on and joke and talk and so on. So it was the quintessential college experience. Baylor was only about 4,000, 4,500 students when I arrived there in 1950 and left in 54. It wasn't a whole lot larger. And so you could know almost everybody on that campus. If you didn't know them personally, you knew who they were. And it was really was a family atmosphere that I found hard to duplicate when I left there. I went to graduate school at three or four other universities, and I enjoyed them all, but because of the academic work that I did. But the feeling of a family atmosphere that I found at Baylor was really unique. And as far as basketball was concerned, I always said that I was Jonah because in the 3 years before I came there, they'd been to the Final Four twice and the right. Final Two once.
Yeah.
And I came there in 1950, and they haven't been back to the Final Four since. So at some point, the curse of the Cole clan is going to have to be erased. And I've been really pulling for Scott Drew to do that. And he is a he's done remarkably well. But anyway, that's kind of the background.
Well, speaking of your time playing at Baylor, actually this comes from our own Brian Etheridge. What would have been your fondest memory playing at Baylor? What was something that still sticks with you today as far as the time playing at Baylor?
Well, I'd like to say that it was because of success that we had as a team or that I had as an individual, but I was a pretty average player, sometimes a little above average and sometimes a little below average. I was the only gym rat that was there all the time I was there. In 4 years, it's remarkable to say this, but in 4 years, once the season was over, I was virtually the only basketball player that went over there and worked out on any kind of regular basis. And I was over there all the time. And even in the fall when we reported, until we started playing three-on-three, we'd have tournaments of three-on-three, the basketball players would. And when we had those tournaments, usually starting sometime in October, early October, before practice really started, we'd do that for a couple of weeks. And until that time, I'd be about the only player over there working out in the fall. The one summer I stayed up there after my sophomore year, I was over in the gym working out, and you know how hot it was in Waco. It was over 100 degrees, 63 straight days, one of those summers I was up there. And so working out in Rena Mars McLean Gymnasium in that kind of heat was not an easy thing. And I really envy the players now, their facilities, and I envy them their equipment. I envy them their the coaching. I have to say that the coaching at Baylor when I was there was it was by my standards at that time it was decent. By the standards today, it doesn't show up on the radar. We had one varsity coach and we had one freshman coach. Coach Bill Henderson was the varsity coach. And Coach Menifee coached the freshman, and he would come up sometimes and go on the trips with us. And he was a great fella, and he was a good coach. He was knowledgeable, but the coaching today, fellas, is far and away superior to anything that was true back then. And I played in the Texas High School All-Star basketball game the summer before I arrived at Baylor, and my coach was Adolph Rupp from Kentucky, one of the all-time Hall of Fame coaches. The coach of the North squad was Hank Iba from Oklahoma State, another one of the all-time great coaches. And I don't know about the Iba, but Rupp, it was kind of a vacation time for him to come up there and give the football coaches a bad time and so on. But he liked me because I caught on to what he was trying to do, and he asked me about it, and I said, well, I read your book. I didn't tell him that when I was growing up in Corpus, the only kind of – you didn't have any coaching going on down there.
Right.
And so the only way I could learn any basketball was go to the library and get all the books. I got Claire B's book. He was at Long Island University, and I got Dolph Ruff's book and several others, and read those books. And you don't really learn basketball through textbooks, but it does help, believe me. It gave me terminology. It gave me an idea of what we were doing and so on. And so he loved me because I read his book, and I didn't tell him in order to get a starting position job on the team, but he started right. me, and he wouldn't take me out. I finally fouled out deliberately with about 2 or 3 minutes to go because it was 95 degrees in old Memorial Gym in Austin where we were having it, and I mean, I was dead in the water, and he literally would not take me out. So I just fouled out and took my seat on the bench, and I was a happy camper. That's the only time I ever did that. But at any rate, I knew what coaching was, and I knew that Baylor, as well as other teams in the old Southwest Conference, had decent coaches for their day. But a lot of them, Mr. Bill, you know, he'd been a football coach. He'd coached everything, and he coached basketball. And he used to tell us that his teams that he took to the Final Four, I don't think they even called it that in those days, that they coached themselves because they were a bunch of veterans from World War II as well as
right.
Two or three really good high school players like Jackie Robinson and Bill Johnson and then Red Owens out of Houston, who may have been the best player on that team, all things considered. And but he had a bunch of older guys on that team. We had a couple of them on our team and that I played with who had been in the Army and so on. And so it was a mature group in lots of ways, and they'd played a lot of basketball. So he used to tell us they coached themselves, and every now and then we'd look at each other and say, yeah, they must have.
They probably did.
So anyway, so go ahead and ask a question.
Yeah, you got there in 1950, so you obviously played freshman basketball that year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they continued to play freshman ball all the way into the 70s.
Right. Okay. So Kendall, who runs the Our Daily Bear site, he had a question here. He said, who's your all-time Baylor 5 starting lineup? So we'll put you on the spot. If you were going to pick a player at each position off the top of your head, who would you go with?
Well, you know, that's a difficult one to answer because, for one thing, we remember the more recent players more vividly.
Sure.
And for another, the more recent players remember that there was no integration really in the Southwest right. Conference until the mid-60s. And that that changed everything. Once the black basketball players began to not just show up at the college level, but understand that many of them came from schools that didn't have facilities, which was ironic because in Corpus, the black high school in Corpus when I was growing up had a nice gym, and they let us come over there and work out in high school. In the preseason, which seems kind of strange comparison, but they had some great athletes at that school. They won our senior year. They won the state football championship, black high school football championship, and I watched them play, and they were amazing. And I think they had all 11 of their starters made all district. I think about 7 or 8 of them were all state, and they sent about 10 or 12 players north to school, to college, because they you know, unless they went to a black college, they couldn't play down in the Southwest and South.
Right. Yeah.
And but I watched them in basketball, and I thought, boy, if we'd have had those guys, but they weren't very good basketball players, interestingly enough. And I often wondered if it was, since they had a gym, if it was because they all worked in the summer or whatever, because they certainly had physically, they had excellent talent, but they yeah. just didn't have very good basketball skills. But what the heck, we didn't either. I mean, and by the standards that prevailed by the 1960s and 70s, our team was... it was a pretty bunch of sad sacks, really, and yet we won 34 of 38 games in, you know, the state championship.
Yeah,
but everybody played everything in those days. When we played Texarkana, they had an all-state halfback playing for them. When we played, that was in the quarterfinals and the semifinals. We played Sweetwater, and almost all of their basketball players are football players. Then we played Vernon in the finals, and all five of their starters had started on their football team.
Right.
One of them went on to become an All-Southwest Conference end at TCU. So everybody played everything except us. We only had one football player on our team. And all the rest of us were, you know, we were just, we played other sports. We had some baseball players and so on. But I didn't play anything but basketball. And so when you talk about picking starters across generations, it's extremely difficult to do. But I have to say that my two favorite guards at Baylor were Michael Williams and Vinny Johnson.
Yeah.
Those two guys both had excellent pro careers, but above and beyond that, they were dominant in college. And if Baylor had someone coaching them other than Coach Iba, who was a slow it down, he was a hyper control guy. He didn't turn them loose to play. And Michael could have whipped anybody, and A&M beat them in the tournament finals, and that wasn't any way A&M should have beaten them. Baylor had better personnel, but they just they played their game played into A&M's strength, and that was that. But Michael was an excellent basketball player. I remember he scored 65 points in a playoff game when he was in high school in Dallas.
Wow.
And Vinny, as one of my best friends who I'd played against in college was Leon Black, who coached, was an assistant and then the head coach, University of Texas. And I mentioned Vinny to him once when we were talking. He looked at me and said, Vinny was from another planet. And that was about the only way to describe him. There wasn't anything he could not do on the basketball floor. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything. I watched him out here. I live out here across from San Francisco in the East Bay. And I went over to watch him play University of San Francisco, and they had Bill Cartwright and the top recruiting class in the country, the top power forward freshman in the country, and one of the top small forwards in the country, plus a couple of other players that were veterans. And Bill was just dominant, and they were undefeated that year until the last game of the season when they went into Notre Dame and got upset. But he ranked number one, and Vinny lit him up for 43 points in the tournament final.
Wow.
I mean, they were literally wringing their hands on the sideline saying, Coach, what can we do to stop this guy?
Right.
Because they tried everything, a zone and one, you know, box and one. They tried doubling. They tried everything. It didn't matter what they tried. He just took them to the cleaners. So those two guards are still they're right at the top of my list. And, you know, you can look at David Wesley, who was a great player. Terry Teagle was a great player. And in my day, my senior year, two guys came up from one from Beaumont South Park and the other from Houston Lamar. Ed Franklin's from Houston Lamar and Jerry Mallett was from Beaumont South Park.
Yeah.
Jerry had hit, I think, something like 12 or 13 straight shots from out on the floor in the state final game in high school. And he was 6'6", and he could shoot from any – his range was just unbelievable. He had just a great shot from anywhere on the floor. He was teachable. I worked with him on a hook shot. He'd never shot a hook shot in his life. I worked with him on a hook shot, and in no time at all, he could shoot that hook shot from the baseline, from either side of the baseline, turning in the direction that was best suited for it. He was an amazing basketball player. He had long arms and huge hands. He could go up. He was you know, it was his rebound record that Rico Gathers broke.
Yeah, absolutely.
Single game record. And Jerry could go up. I saw him against Arkansas. He just ate them alive there in Waco at Arena Mars McLean. He just took them apart. He would take the ball off the board. He would dribble it the length of the floor and score. He would throw it the length of the floor to someone who's open. He was just, and I saw him twice against Big Eight guard from Oklahoma State. They came into Baylor to play. He went out there late in the game and stole the ball from him twice out on the top and went down and dunked it both times. And because he had those long arms and those quick hands, and he just could reach out there and tap that ball away and then beat the guy to it. His roommate was Dale Schaffner, if you can imagine that. And he challenged Dale to a 40-yard dash, and so they went out to the old Muni Stadium, and they lined up on the goal line. They ran 40 yards, and Mallett beat him.
Wow.
Wow.
Now, Schaffner was a great sprinter, but he was he didn't have the start that – I mean, Mallett could come out of the starting block almost full speed. He could take a step or two, and he was going full blast. And he had those long legs, and he could really get up and down the floor. He was just – he would have been a great player in any era.
Right.
And Syracuse wanted to draft him, and Mr. Bill told him that he was going to sign a baseball contract. So he never had the option of picking – a pro basketball career. He was going to be picked for the college all-star game. And Mr. Bill told the coach that called that Jerry wouldn't be interested in playing in it.
Wow.
Why? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think there was some kind of antagonism there that I never really understood, but that happens. That happens.
Yeah, sure.
Jerry and then Daryl Hardy, who some people don't know, hardly know his name, played in the mid '60s. And Daryl came out of Houston at 6'7", and he was as good as anybody in that era. I mean, he could jump, he could get off the floor, he could score, he could rebound. Was a decent defender. You know, you've got a few guys from that, and you know, you had a bunch of guys back there that could shoot the basketball,
right?
But they weren't as athletic as these guys are today, a lot of them, and that's kind of another story. So I really find it hard. You know, we all know who the great players have been in the Drew era, and he's had some really good ones, but I have to go back and pick up some of these old timers and just tell you that if you put them out there today, they could play with any of these guys. They could really play. And that wasn't true of my era. My era and the earlier era, the Final Four teams had really good players on them for that period.
Right.
But by today's standards, I'm sorry. neither they nor my crew. we couldn't do it with this bunch.
Well, speaking of that your generation and even between there to now, there's obviously been a lot of changes in the game of basketball at the NCAA level and up to the NBA level, but and I know you've already discussed how you're envious of the facilities and the coaching and the technology, you know, everything they have nowadays. But this is a question from Son of a Bear on the board that in your mind, how has the game changed at the NCAA level since you played to now, and where do you see it going next as far as the actual game on the court?
Well, there are two or three things that in my lifetime of coming up and then playing and then coaching a little bit in the Army and 3 years in high school and then watching a lot of basketball over the years, I remember what Pete Newell, who was one of the all-time great coaches, the coach's coach, conducted the big man camps out there in Hawaii for quite a long while. He pointed out that the game really itself had changed very little fundamentally, and players are bigger and they're faster. But he put it, way he put it, he said the angles and the coziness, I lack that word, are the cosines of angles that don't change. And basketball is a game of angles. It's remarkably similar to what it's always been in that regard. And the old saying, everybody's got an angle. Well, in basketball, the person who has the angle is the one who wins. Right. And when you're playing basketball, you only have the ball in your hands about 10% of the time you're on the floor. And so it's really what you do that other 90% of the time that matters most. And right. most people don't understand that. It's a game not of arms and hands, but it's a game of feet. You've got to be able to move your feet. You've got to be able to anticipate. You've got to be able to put yourself in the right position to take the right angle and so on. And so the major changes that I've seen in my lifetime were the jump shot. And I argued with Mr. Bill one day, and he got so mad at me. It was after I'd come out of the Army and come back to Baylor to get my teaching credential, and I hung out over there and talked to him pretty often. And I told him, I said, this was 1957. I said, Mr. Bill, Hank Iba's never gonna win another championship, and he's never probably gonna go very far and deep in the playoffs. And he bristled, because he and Iba were good friends. And I told him, I said, he won't let anybody shoot the jump shot. He makes them still shoot set shots. And I said, we're talking 1957. I said, he doesn't like to run. He likes to slow the ball down. And he is hyper-controlling in terms of his. And I said, players don't like to do that. The best players don't want to play that kind of basketball. I said, it broke my heart a couple of years ago when Matt Carter from out there at Barger, who was one of the best offensive performers of that entire era in Texas high school basketball. He's about 6'5", 6'6", and he could jump out of the gym. He was built like a spider. I mean, he was all arms and legs. Yeah. And he could, around the basket, he was almost impossible to stop. And why he picked Oklahoma State, other than the fact that he lived up there near the Oklahoma line. And Oklahoma and Oklahoma State drew a lot of players, still do, out of that right. North Texas and West Texas area. And he went to Oklahoma State, and he averaged right at 17 points a game, which was miraculous. For any other team, he'd have been averaging 10 points a game more than that.
Right.
And I told Mr. Mill, I said, players aren't going to want to play that kind of game anymore. And he was angry. And I said, I'm sorry, but I think I have my hand on the pulse of where the game is going, and it's not going back to that kind of basketball. It's evolving, and the jump shot is, it's changed the game. And then you had integration come along, and boy, that was a huge change right there, because black talent, which had been denied for so long, now began to flood in. It took a long time for it to get its full measure in the South and Southwest. But boy, when it did, the difference that it made was just remarkable. And in every sport, but particularly in my view in basketball, because the Southwest, and I'm not talking about just college. I'm talking about urban basketball, because it's interesting. Most people don't realize that the cities did not produce most of the best basketball players in the state of Texas through the 1930s and 40s and into the 1950s. They came from small towns. So, yeah, the cities produced some, but most of the really good basketball players were coming from small towns, some of them where they didn't play anything but basketball the year round. And, So all at once, with integration, the facilities began to be better. You began to have city rec gyms open to these players, and so on. And they began to move increasingly into basketball all over the United States. This was happening. A lot of people don't realize that Harlem was at one time a Jewish ghetto, and right. basketball was a Jewish sport. And they produced some outstanding basketball players. One of them, the best player in New York City, coming out of high school in the 1950s, was also a pitcher of note who went on to become a Hall of Fame pitcher for the Dodgers, and left-handed pitcher that everybody was. Sandy Koufax.
He's a good basketball player, huh?
Oh, when he was in high school, they scrimmaged the New York Knicks, a group of high schoolers, and he lit the Knicks up. I mean, wow. He literally ate them alive, and he went to Cincinnati on a basketball scholarship. And after a year, I think it was a year, maybe two, he went to the pros in baseball. He worked out for Pittsburgh and for the Dodgers in Pittsburgh. Branch Rickey was at Pittsburgh, and he wanted him badly. He said, "I've never seen an arm like that." But his son said, "Well, I saw him pitch in high school a couple of years ago, and he got lit up. He was wild, and then he'd have to come in, and they'd just rack him." And so he talked his dad out of it. And then he worked out for Walter Alston. And after about 10 pitches, Alston's catcher walked over to him and said, "Whatever it costs, you got to sign this guy."
Yeah.
So he became a Dodger, even though he was offered $15,000 more by Ricky. He was so insulted. He and his father were so insulted by the way he was treated that he wouldn't sign with him. Anyway, they had some great, great basketball players in New York, but yeah. The influx of black talent in that area, of course, was phenomenal, and so it became an urban game, and that's when the difference really came along, because you simply had a lot more talent in urban areas, and once it began to be concentrated in basketball, and the next thing that changed it, and we're just now seeing the results of that, was a 3-point shot.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, yeah. So speaking of that, so how did you get to the Bay Area? And you know, I'd love to hear your comments on how the game is continuing to evolve and what you see with Golden State and just the spacing on the floor and just the incredible, you know, having, you know, five guys that can all attack the basket do you think it's a, I mean, is this brand of basketball the best basketball you've ever seen in your life? I guess with Golden State, that would be my question.
Well, it's right there with the Showtime Lakers. That was just when you're talking about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Worthy and Magic Johnson, you could put any two peg leg guys out there with them, and they did. They had other good players, but my gosh. Those guys were wonderful to watch, and of course the Celtics with Bird and Parrish, McHale, and Johnson and Ainge. That was a great unit as well. And you got Bill Walton coming off the bench, and even though he was damaged goods, he was still a fine player.
Right.
So you know it's hard for me to again you're talking about across eras with different. Because none of those teams could have stayed with the Warriors in terms of speed and quickness and shooting. The Warriors just were they're very special. But on the other hand, it would be interesting to see how they would try to defend each other. But I came out here. I coached 3 years in Texas, and then I got out of coaching. I wasn't temperamentally suited for it. I made two terrible mistakes. One was my temperament. I let my ego get too much involved in my coaching, and that's always a very, very dangerous thing to do. And it's a thing that a lot of young coaches do. The other thing was that I overcoached. I didn't have really good basketball players. My basketball team was made up in part of football players, and so I didn't have really good athletes or great athletes to overcome the problems that go with a lack of training and repetition and so on. And I realized one morning when I couldn't get out of bed, I was paralyzed. It was after a tournament, and I had not enjoyed the the officiating at that tournament. Where they used high school tournaments back in those days, used guys that officiated football and basketball.
Yeah.
And so the football officials who came over to officiate basketball were partial to the teams that they were representing and to the areas they were representing, because they were hired by the same athletic directors or coaches to coach both, to officiate both sports. And I took my little team and to play a big football team, and those guys literally beat my guys to death. You could hear them slapping across the court. My center, who was a high jumper and a really good player, but only about 6'2", 6'2 and a half. He came over and said, "Coach, look at my arm." And he had welts on his arm where they'd slapped him. And you could hear it. You could hear it all over the gym. And they'd never tweeted their whistle. And I raised my concerns with them. And one of them said, "Coach, if you say another word, you're going to be out of this building. We'll have you tossed." And I said, "Well, I won't say any more." So that was it. But the next day I couldn't get out of bed, and I had to call a doctor, and he came and he talked to me, and he ran a tub of hot water and rolled me out of bed and helped me get in that tub of water. And he said, "Son, you better either change your attitude or you better change your profession." And I knew my attitude was not good, but it was not likely to be changed. So I changed my profession. I just went into the classroom, which I enjoyed anyway, and went to graduate school and got my degrees that enabled me to go into community college teaching. And I came out to California and teach in a community college for over 30 years right here in Fremont, which is about 20 miles from the Oracle Coliseum up there. And I want you to know, I don't apologize to anybody today for enjoying these Warrior victories, because you talk about going through some lean times.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The Warrior fans are the most loyal in the NBA. They sold out that Coliseum year after year, and they enlarged it, and they still sold it out. And it was miserable. It was miserable. I can't begin to tell you how we suffered. So,
well, when you spend your number one pick on Joe Barely Cares, I guess.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Oh, you can go down the list. You can go down the list. We had I think a number two or three pick once, and we spent it on that 6'11 kid from North Carolina State. I can't remember his name.
Washburn.
Yeah. Chris Washburn. And he was an incredible physical talent. I mean, that guy was he had more physical talent than anybody you'd want to look at, but he was a total head case.
Right.
And anybody who says that character doesn't matter in professional sports, they haven't been around very long.
Right.
And so anyway, I went over, a bunch of us would meet every year for the draft meeting, bunch of the fans that met on the message board, and we'd meet over at a big sports bar. Man, we went over there, and I watched Minnesota pass up Steph Curry twice. And I thought, they took two other guards. They took Ricky Rubio and they took a kid named Johnny Flynn, who didn't even last more than a couple of years.
Yep.
And he fell to the Warriors, and I knew right then that things were going to change. I didn't know how much they would change, but I knew they were going to change. But I also knew that Monte Ellis was not a good backcourt mate to him because it's too small a backcourt.
Right.
So once they traded him, and then they drafted Klay Thompson, and then they drafted Draymond Green, and they drafted, you know, they just went down the line drafting some talent to go with them. And my goodness, the change, it was remarkable. But Curry is a swizzle stick that stirs that drink, even with
right.
Durant, who in my view is going to wind up being a top six or eight player historically in the NBA before he's done. I mean, I've watched a lot of basketball, and I would put him right there. I'd put him very close to my top five. I felt that way about him when he was in Oklahoma City, and now that he's playing in a free flowing offense and he's able to do the things that he's capable of doing in that offense and in that defense, he's made an even stronger case.
But, yeah,
it's the three point shot has really changed the game dramatically, and in my view, for the better. But then, see, I was an outside shooter, as my nickname would indicate, and Mr. Bill would let me shoot it two or three times, and if I didn't hit immediately, he'd either take me out of the game or he'd call me over and say, work the ball inside. And I understood that. That's what all the coaches did, is pound it inside.
Sure.
Well, if the three-point shot only counts 2 points, that is to say, if you're shooting from 25 feet, which I did, I was a two-handed set-shot shooter, and I could hit it from a long distance. Sometimes I hit and sometimes I didn't. But if you don't give a guy a chance to kind of get into a shooting rhythm, it's kind of hard to do that. And I'm real sympathetic to some of these, like Jake Lindsey. You know, Jake Lindsey's got a good 3-point shot, a really good 3-point shot. He's got excellent form. He's got a great release. He's got great rotation on the ball. But if he's not going to shoot it more than about two or three times a game, then that's not going to be all that helpful. He's got to put if he's a shooter, he's got to work for his shot more than that.
Right.
And I think he will. But no, the 3-point shots made all the difference in the world. Now, how much difference? You see, the Warriors lucked out because they got Curry and Thompson, and you're talking about two of the greatest 3-point shooters that have ever played the game, right there.
Yep.
And and then you get Durant coming in,
talking about
a guy that not only is a really fine 3-point shooter, but he's impossible to keep from shooting it because he elevates so high when he shoots.
Right.
A big man can't come out on him because he'll take him off the dribble. A smaller man just simply cannot prevent him from shooting that shot. And Thompson's 6'7", and he releases the ball up high. So this is an unusual group of shooters, and I'm not sure how easy it is to duplicate that.
Right.
I believe, you know, I look at Baylor, and I'm looking at McClure, who has one of the sweetest strokes you'll ever see in your life.
Yep.
I mean, he's got a beautiful stroke. And I noticed that you said that he had lost a little weight and trimmed up a bit, and that should help him, his maneuverability.
Right.
But my goodness, Larry Bird had a great three-point shot. He won the first two three-point contests they ever had.
Right.
He came in the dressing room for the and the first one. He said, "Well, y'all are all competing for second place. Who's going to win it?" And then he went out and did it. But he would come out. I when they'd come into Oakland to play, I'd go over there and watch him. And he would come out 2 hours ahead of everybody.
And get up.
And he would go all over that court, just examining in detail, step by step, where he was on that court so that he would know where he wanted to release that ball from.
Right.
And it was remarkable. He came in once, and they were having a little shoot around game. They'd come in a day early, and he went diving for a loose ball up in the chair, scattered chairs all over that court, and everybody there just gasped. I mean, you're talking about the MVP of the league, and they're just playing a 3-on-3 game, and he's out there diving on the floor up in the chairs. Bill Fitch never looked around, but he heard the gasp, and he said loud enough for everybody to hear, he said, the good players do that in practice.
Yeah,
I do that in games. The superstars, he said, do it in practice.
Wow.
And but Bird didn't really work to get that shot because he was too team-oriented, and he had the inside game. They had the inside game, and nobody imagined the three-point shot. See, it's got to get into your imagination.
Yeah.
There's a saying by Arthur Schopenhauer, who is a philosopher.
Yeah.
And he said that talent is hitting the target nobody else can hit. Genius is hitting the target nobody else can see.
Mm.
And by that standard, Steph Curry is a basketball genius.
Right.
Because several basketball old-timers like Isaiah Thomas and Chauncey Billups and others have said that in their day, if somebody took a shot from the distances that he takes the shots from, they'd have simply kind of waved at him and said, welcome to that one, buddy.
Right.
But he hits that shot. So
right.
he's redefined that game. And now you're seeing more and more players who are willing to venture out further and further.
Yeah.
To take that shot.
Yep.
And that gets to the point you were making about spacing the floor. If you're taking that shot just from the confines of the corner area and that sideline area where it's a short shot, that's one thing. But when you start taking them out there from 30 feet and hitting them, now, I mean, that's inconceivable because now they've got to come way out there almost to half court to guard you.
Right.
And that's a whole different game. And I don't know whether college players are capable of extending the court like that or not, or whether their coaches would let them.
Well, but, we saw Phil Forte is really one of the only ones I can think of in recent memory. I mean, Phil Forte for Oklahoma State would.
Oh yeah, I'm telling you, absolutely. Yeah, Hill could shoot well from the distance, but he didn't shoot from that kind of distance.
Right.
He normally shot it, a little bit closer to that 3-point line,
right.
Because he could get up in the air and get it off pretty quickly. He could get a shot pretty much when he wanted. And if Manu LeCompte was 5 inches taller, he'd be able to do the same thing.
Sure.
But he has to work with his lack of height, he has to work so much harder.
There's a player coming into Baylor who they there's a lot of buzz about him having that Steph Curry range,
yes.
And that's Jeremiah Gambrell.
Yeah, I saw him shoot in videos over a year ago after his freshman year.
Right.
And he can light it up.
Right.
Now, he's 6 feet now, I think he said,
in
one of your write-ups, and because he was smaller than that then, and it'd be nice if he could put another inch or two up there. I don't know what kind of defender he is, but I'll guarantee you he can shoot the ball.
And
actually, there is no substitute for being able to shoot that basketball.
Right, yeah.
I don't care. I played a lot of defense. I had to because I wasn't real fast and I couldn't jump a lot. So I had to learn how to play position defense and how to anticipate and so on. And I was a really good defender. But there were guys that I just didn't want to guard.
Right, right.
When I was in the Army, I coached and played the same time. And I was better then than I was in college. Believe me, little maturity helps.
Yeah.
But we played we played a team from White Sands Proving Ground, and I had a player on my team, played University of Houston, Sammy Adams, and I'd say, Sammy, I want you to guard this guy. First time he did it, he didn't know who he was. Well, I knew who he was because I'd already played against him once that season. He was from North Carolina College, a black college in North Carolina.
Yeah.
This was 1955, and he had an odd little old kind of two-hand shot from just above his eye level, and he had a kind of a running one-hand shot, but he didn't have a pure jump shot, but he had the quickest first step I'd ever seen on a guy 6'4" in my life. So I was smart enough to put Sammy on him. And we played him two or three more times along the way, and we beat him every time because he didn't have a whole lot with him, but he was good enough to make to be picked up for the Army, for the all-service tournament. He played for the Army All-Stars, and the Celtics saw him there, and they picked him first when the draft came around. They picked Sam Jones in that draft. And he learned to shoot that jump shot as soon as he got to Boston. And he was a Hall of Famer, and he deserved it. He was just a great, great basketball player. And, it's just, you know, when you talk about going across eras and so on, it's hard to do. But the fact is, when you see a great player in any era, you know what you're looking at. Well, even if you don't know much about the game.
Yeah. Well, this has been this has been awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time. Before we go, I do want to hear about, you were recently, you saw Clyde Hart receive an award. Can you give us a couple minutes about that?
Yeah, I went to Sacramento Saturday, and it would have warmed the cockles of every Baylor fan's heart because, he was, first of all, they made the presentation, and it was a delightful presentation. They praised him, rightfully so, and then he made a few remarks, and then they got on with the meet. And that wasn't very long after that that they ran the 400-meter race, and I really did not expect Will London to do very, very well against that quality of competition. I mean, you're talking about really some of the best 400 meter runners in the world. There were nine people in that race, and eight of them, the eighth runner in that race ran a 44.8.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But anyway, Clyde had told him that, he said, you need to not get out too fast. He said, don't worry about it. You're in lane one. He turned something that was adverse to him into a positive for him. He said, you're where you can see everybody ahead of you. And he said, they're going to go out real fast. And said, some of them went out fast yesterday, and they're going to be tired. So you pick off these scragglers, and if you can make the top six, you're in the pool to go to London.
Yeah.
And it came as he said, the biggest surprise of his coaching career when Will, I was sitting 5 yards from the finish line, and when they passed, Will was in fourth place, and he passed Nellums, who was an Olympian and a national champion. He passed him in that last 5 yards or 5 meters, and took third. And Curley was he was tying up, and so was Gil Roberts, the former Tech runner who was right with him most of the race. They were both tying up. If that race had gone another 6 or 8 meters, Will would have, he'd have caught him because he still had something left when he crossed that finish line. They were tying up, and he was just blaring right on through it. It was remarkable. And after that, I went over to the, after the beat was pretty much over, I went up to the reception that they gave for him. And, Michael Johnson was making remarks, and he really made some wonderful comments. And one of his comments was something every Baylor person can relate to. He said that when he came to Baylor, Clyde insisted to every athlete that was there that they not embarrass themselves, that they not embarrass their families and that they not embarrass the university.
Yeah.
And that he reiterated that time and again until it was drilled into them. And he said that he had never forgotten that, and that was as important to him as anything he had ever taught him in terms of running. And after we kind of broke up for refreshments, a fella came by, and I thought I recognized him because I followed track and field very closely out on the coast for a long time. He was a great runner back in the 70s and into the very early 80s. And he came up and grabbed Clyde and hugged him and told him who he was. Clyde, of course, recognized him immediately. And he said, "Coach, I want to tell you, we used to go to meets. And Baylor, when Baylor showed up, we'd say, oh, gosh, here comes another 3-4 or 3-5, which back in that days was championship quality 4x4.
Yeah.
And he said, we look at each other and say, he goes out and he must go out. We never heard of these guys. He must go out into the backwoods somewhere and just grab them and bring them in and teach them how to run, because they run us into the ground every time we line up against them." And I had to break down laughing because that was only partly true. But he did get a number of his best runners from small high schools where they ran on dirt tracks, and brought them in, like Brendan Couts and others. He brought them in, and he made them, once he got them there, he turned them into champions. But I thought that was a really sweet, comment for this fellow to make. And the love and affection that these people had for Clyde just reminded me of how much he's taken for granted in Waco. And I've always had the view, Ashley, that that's a term that we often use almost to denigrate someone, that, you're taking me for granted. So,
right.
That's the highest compliment someone can pay you.
Yeah.
Is that you have set a standard.
Right.
That you adhere to and that you consistently measure up to, so that people know when you go out there, whether it's as a coach or whatever it is you're doing in life, they know what they're going to get from you, and they can take it for granted. I consider that one of the highest compliments you can pay.
Yeah.
Clyde has been taken for granted. He's much more admired in Asia and in Europe by the sporting fraternities there than he has been in many cases here.
Right.
But he's been a tremendous asset to Baylor University, and it was clear at that meeting. Fact is, I had some guy come by as he was walking out after Will London's race. He looked at my Baylor shirt and he said, "Well, Baylor showed up today as usual." And I thought, boy, that's wonderful. And I thank you for letting me share that with the people on your message board.
Oh, well, thank you. This has been awesome, and we sure appreciate the time. And let's do it again. Let's do it again sometime in basketball season and get your
thoughts. Yeah, we didn't even get to talk about Baylor basketball.
Not much, but
no, that's all right.
We can do it again and do that.
All right. I love it. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stacy. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.